Third case of the day, the United States v. Wilson. Mr. Moorman.
May it please the Court, I'm Ed Moorman. I represent the defendant. This defendant pled guilty to conduct that would have given him 46 to 57 months under the guidelines, but a lot of so-called relevant conduct was added to that, so he wound up with 180 months, really three times as much. The allegations that the judge relied on were made by criminals who talked to the police, and one of these criminals wasn't named, but another one said that it was Daniel Wilson who was involved in some drug sales, and these additional facts, although they weren't directly tied to the current charge, which was possession with intent to deliver some cocaine, they were considered by the court as part of the instant offense. And so under the guidelines that applied with all this additional fact material that the court believed, this man got 180 months instead of the maximum of 57 months that he would have gotten under the guidelines.
Is it your argument, counsel, that the district court's findings on relevant conduct were clearly erroneous?
Yes.
Because I did not see in your appendix any transcript containing those findings or written decision containing those findings, so it's a little difficult for us to review that without the transcript, or if there was a written decision, the written decision.
Well, it is a part of the transcript. I guess we didn't attach it, but he did consider what these criminals had told the police as part of his sentencing hearing, and then in fact wouldn't let the defendant require production of their criminal records themselves. He said he knew these people, and so he was aware of these criminals, and so even their records did not become part of the record.
Well, here, if the judge was familiar with their criminal histories, then why would that have been important to put the piece of paper in the record?
I mean, by not permitting that to be a part of the record here, there's no way to exercise any kind of oversight. We don't know. I mean, we know that the judge said, I know about their criminal records.
Well, it's often the case that co-defendants in drug cases and co-actors, even if they're not co-defendants in drug cases, form the factual basis for relevant conduct findings. That's fairly common, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Yes, it is.
So what's the problem with it here?
I think it's generally a problem. I mean, it's a problem here.
So we should put a stop to that practice.
Well, I think it'd be a good idea to put a stop to that practice. But, I mean, but I understand that that's, you know, that I'm not likely to make that as a persuasive argument. On the other hand, here, you have one of these people saying Daniel Wilson, not Daryl, who is the defendant here. That's one of the things he told the police. Daniel Wilson was involved in some drug sales. Another one of the criminals was not named. So it's hard to make an evaluation of how much he really knew about this. These are not people who established clearly from the facts that they were very well aware of this particular defendant. One of them either got his name wrong and therefore must not have known him too well, or he was talking about somebody whose name is Daniel Wilson, some unknown person. They figured, well, he's talking about Daryl. So,
Was there testimony from a police officer who tied up that detail? Since we don't have the transcript,
The police officer did say that he talked to these people, and he said he believed them. Or I don't know if he specifically said he believed them, but at least he talked to them and presumably believed them and recounted what they had to say.
And did that officer verify for the district court that these co-defendants or co-actors were all talking about the same person, that is to say your client?
He presented his testimony in such a way that obviously he figured they were talking about the same person, even though he did say that one of them mentioned Daniel Wilson and not Daryl.
And did you have the opportunity to cross-examine on that?
Actually, I was not there at the time, but the attorney that I took over for, yes. I mean, that fellow was there. I mean, the attorney was there. The police officer could have been cross-examined. Obviously, the criminals who talked to the police officer were not there.
Right.
And were not cross-examined. Couldn't have been.
But there was an opportunity to cross-examine the police officer.
Yes.
Through
yes.
whom this evidence was being admitted.
Correct. Yes.
And so we have a situation where the district court simply reconciled that discrepancy, the name discrepancy, in favor of the government.
That's what he did.
And ordinarily we defer to that, right, under the clearly erroneous standard?
Certainly the standard is to defer to what the trial judge did about credibility. And if he believed but he's doing more than making a judgment here about the credibility of the police officer. He is letting the police officer's judgment about the credibility of the hearsay, judge, because he has no other way to measure that credibility. The information's coming from those criminals.
Well,
their recounting is, and I realize that happens.
A fair amount of the relevant conduct, though, was attributable to statements made by your client to the officer. Isn't that right?
Some of it was. That's probably the weakest point of my case. But the prosecution, the government, obviously, thought it was important to bring in this hearsay and to bring in what these criminals said. They didn't rely on these statements of the defendant. They presented to the court, for the court's consideration, the statements of these criminals. And really, not only was it the relevant conduct that came, but all of this depends on what this extraneous hearsay from criminals. It also goes to the matter of whether or not this conduct was committed within 2 years of release on a previous charge, because if it was just what he was charged with in this case, it would have been 5.5 years later, not within two. But if you bring in I'm calling it criminal hearsay, but I mean the hearsay from the criminals who talked to the police, then you get it within 2 years. So that enhances him even more. So essentially, that information, which is the basis of this appeal, that information and the use of that information is what gives him all this additional time, triples his time. That is...
You want to reserve some time?
Yes, I do.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Moorman. Mr. Porter.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Jim Porter, and I'm an Assistant United States Attorney from the Southern District of Illinois.
You're here to help us.
I believe so, Your Honors. Your Honor, clearly the District Court properly determined Mr. Wilson's advisory guidelines using his admissions and the statements of the others and the testimony of the police officers. The statements of Mr. Wilson's suppliers and his customers.
Mr. Carter, what evidence in the record is there of drug dealing in 2000, 2001, 2003, and the first half of 2002 and the first half of 2003?
Mr. Wilson's own admission that he began drug dealing and continued drug dealing since shortly after his release from prison.
I appreciate that, but where's the end point? I mean, suppose he was released from prison in 1990 rather than 1998, and he said, I've been buying drugs since I released from prison. So is a district judge then permitted to say, well, that's right up to the date of the PSR?
Maybe not in the situation that you outlined, Judge Flom, but in the situation that we had here, the district court heard evidence from the suppliers and customers that indicated that Mr. Wilson's statement was accurate, that he had continuously engaged in a pattern of drug dealing since his release or since shortly after his release from prison.
I appreciate that, and I'm aware of our case law, but don't we need a little more specificity when we have a start date, that is, assuming not dealing in prison, of late 98. And then we just have he's been shopping and buying and dealing drugs since. I mean, is that we don't need any more anything little harder than that is.
Well, I think the guidelines clearly state that any part of the incident offense includes all relevant conduct, and all the relevant conduct was all of the drug dealing he engaged in.
Yeah, but how do we know how relevant the conduct is? I mean, certainly if he's dealing in drugs, that's pretty relevant conduct. It's just when, because it's a big enhancement here, or substantial enhancement, and if he did it for a year, you know, after he was out. It's sort of the gap for me that we just have to take a leap of faith that there's been this dealing right, you know, relevant close to the time of arrest.
Well, Your Honor, I think the leap of faith is much easier to understand if it comes directly from the defendant himself. If you recall the situation here when he made that statement, he was attempting to help himself. If you recall that he was arrested, the facts of this case, taken down to the marshal's office in East St. Louis, Illinois, and was asked whether or not he wanted to cooperate and give a truthful statement to the DEA officers who had been part of the arrest team. Mr. Wilson indicated to them that he did want to do that. At the time of the day, it was in the late afternoon, and the marshal's office was closing, so Mr. Wilson was told that if you, in fact, want to do that, you can leave, get in your own car, drive up to Fairview Heights, Illinois, to the DEA office, and we'll resume talking to you then. He was allowed to leave. He was given his car back, all everything he had with him except the cocaine, of course, and he drove up to the DEA office. And they asked him about his drug dealing, and in fact, him mentioning some of these people is what led DEA to find them to add to his relevant conduct. So I think given the entire factual situation, there's no leap of faith that the district court was abundantly satisfied and was properly so that Mr. Wilson's drug dealing had continued unabated since his release from prison, and that's what he was doing.
So you believe his statements give support that from 98 till, you know, the time he speaks to DEA, it's a fair read that he's saying he's been dealing since he left prison.
Your Honor, his statement, coupled with the fact that the DEA could find no evidence to the contrary, coupled with the fact that he never tried to withdraw that statement or limit it in any fashion. His attack at the district court level was simply, you can only sentence me based upon the cocaine that was found in my possession at the time. You can't sentence me based on any other statements. Why he did not choose to challenge his statement, if it were untrue, I really couldn't tell you, obviously. But that is another, I think, very important factor that would gave the district court more than ample satisfaction that his statement was, in fact, correct.
What exactly were the district court's fact findings, and what were they based on? Since nobody attached a transcript, I'm kind of in the dark on that.
The district court heard testimony from the officers and from the probation officer concerning the statements of each individual and the manner of their statements and what they were. And using those statements, the district court approximated levels of cocaine that would be attributable to Mr. Wilson and, in fact, used Mr. Wilson's own statement to do that as well.
So the findings of the district court were expressly premised upon the defendant's own admissions to the agent as well as the witnesses' statements to the agent?
Yes, ma'am, they were.
And the witnesses discussed amounts that they were buying from the defendant?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. And so it was an extrapolation of amount over time?
Yes, ma'am.
Is there some reason why the transcript is unavailable?
No, ma'am. The transcript is part of the record, and I cite to it in my brief pages.
So it could have been attached to the appendix.
I guess it could have, except it was maybe it would have to have been edited down to meet length requirements. But
it's not sealed.
No, ma'am.
Okay.
Your Honor, clearly, the United States believes that the district court was correct in all of its findings in this regard, including the obstruction of justice enhancement and the use of the uncharged conduct, And the district court, as the court has already pointed out, indicated its familiarity with the criminal records of the individuals and indicated that the district court needed nothing more.
On the obstruction of justice enhancement, what is the evidence that once we have access to the transcript, it will show that there was a fleeing on the part of the defendant here?
The evidence, when you look at the transcript, will be the testimony of one of the deputy United States marshals who was conducting the arrest, who indicated that Mr. Wilson tried to accelerate his vehicle past the deputy when the deputy came up to arrest him, almost striking the deputy and almost striking another deputy who was trying to pull his vehicle in front of Mr. Wilson's vehicle to prevent his escape. And Mr. Wilson did not indicate that this didn't happen. He indicated that he was simply surprised by the deputy showing up at his cocaine transaction to arrest him, and that he had maybe accidentally accelerated. The deputy United States Marshal was asked whether he thought, based on the circumstance of being there and everything, whether he thought it was an accident. He indicated it was not, and the district court chose to believe the marshals who testified concerning this over Mr. Wilson's accidental theory.
The acceleration that occurred spanned what amount?
A short amount, because the other deputy was pulling his car in front at the same time. So he couldn't accelerate very far. Based on all of the elements of this case that are in the transcript and in the record, Your Honor, I would urge that the district court, I would urge that the sentence of the district court be affirmed, because I think the district court properly analyzed the situation, applied the advisory guidelines, and came to the correct conclusions. If there are no further questions, I'll sit down now. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Porter. Mr. Mormon.
That obstruction of justice really involved backing up a few feet, going up forward a few feet. And they all testified it was really just 2 or 3 feet. But one of the officers said that he was afraid that he was going to try to accelerate and go after him. It wasn't a case of a speeding car narrowly missing an officer. It was backing up a few feet, going forward a few feet, almost hitting the other car, which had pulled in front of him, and stopping. So it was movement of the car, but it wasn't very much movement. It was just a few feet, and even in cross-examination of the officer, he said it was consistent with somebody just, the movement itself was consistent with somebody just trying to get parked and moving back and forward a little bit. But he did say he was concerned and he was afraid. And
did he say he thought the defendant was trying to flee?
Trying to flee? It was more that he was trying to do some damage. And I think he did say that he thought he was trying to maneuver so he could flee, but he was hemmed in so that it was really just a few feet back and a few feet up. There are no other questions.
You have another minute, Mr. Mormon, but
I think all we have here is just such an extraordinary enhancement. It's all within general the general affirmances that you see all the time. Well, the judge can look over this and he can make a judgment, but when enhancements get to this size, you realize it almost undermines the whole plea process. I mean, you don't know if you're going to get what you think you're going to get or whether you're going to get twice that or three times that. I think it demands a serious look.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Mormon. Thank you, Mr. Porter. Safe trip home to both of you, and we'll move to the fourth case.